Welcome back, one and all, to another exciting episode of the Religious Studies Project. We are still here in the... What did you say it was called?
It is the Abbey.
The Abbey, yes. And we're still drinking the same beers that we were last week.
Here are we.
They know who we are. I'm David Robertson.
And I'm Christopher Carte.
That's right.
We've got to get our names out there, man. It's the only reason we do this podcast.
Hey, well, I'm going to be talking a bit about the Open University conference that I was at later on at the end of this episode. One thing that happened was several people recognised me from my voice from the podcast.
Wow.
That was weird. Anyway, let's get into this week's interview. Chris, at the Socrel conference last month, interviewed Peter Collins on the subject of religion and the built environment. Sounds fascinating. Let's hear what Peter Collins has got to say.
Sitting for the past few days in a sociology of religion conference in a chemistry department at the historic Durham University, surrounded by magisterial churches and cathedrals, eating in the great hall of Durham Castle, and gently meandering home across bridges which seem to have stood in their place since the dawn of time, one starts to get the impression of just how important and influential the built environment is upon every moment of our lives. I'm joined today in Durham by Dr. Peter Collins, who's a senior lecturer in anthropology at Durham University. Among his more relevant works to this interview, he is the co-editor on two books, one called Locating the Field, Space, Place and Context in Anthropology, and another, Reading Religion in Text and Context, Reflections of Faith and Practice in Religious Materials, the first with Simon Coleman and the second with Elizabeth Arwick. Though we will, of course, put a sort of more robust publications list on the website. So first off, Peter, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thanks.
I am going to have to occasionally glance at the recorder just to make sure it's still recording. Unfortunately, the microphone that we use for the wide angle doesn't have the screen, so you have to keep constantly looking around. So what we're talking about today is the broad topic of religion and the built environment. But I wondered, to start us off, if you could just give us an introduction to the whole sort of study of the built environment. Is it a fairly recent phenomenon? What was the history there? And before we get into the actual religious buildings and built environment, just what potential has the built environment for research in general?
Okay. Well, it makes a change not to start off with definitions, and we'll come back to those maybe.
Yeah.
It's a relatively recent area of interest, I would say, as is material culture, of which it's a part. Material culture, I suppose, has become quite a sexy topic over the last 15 or 20 years, maybe. Now we think of figures like, Webke in anthropology, Birgit Meyer, who's known to sociologists and anthropologists, David Morgan, who spoke to us at this conference yesterday. I guess these are the most prominent figures in scholarship relating to material culture. But it's interesting that while material culture broadly has grown over the last couple of decades, there's still very little work done on the built environment, which you would think would be probably the most prominent aspect of material culture. It's a thing that's clearly most in your face. So I'm still perplexed as to why so few people bother with the built environment, even those within the field, more specifically, of material culture. I guess this is the area of mediation and ways in which religion is mediated, and it seems that people are concentrating, like David Morgan yesterday, he was talking about focal objects, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that he hardly mentioned buildings. Lots of smaller...
Pictures, statues, amulets and things.
Exactly,
like that.
Yeah, the small things. And I wonder sometimes whether it's because buildings are so bloody obvious, so huge and so manifest, that we don't see them. Rather like I was talking to somebody in Durham just the other day, And saying I've been up to the cathedral. I've lived here for 20 years, and that's probably about the fourth or fifth time I've been to the cathedral. And this chap who lives around the corner from where I live has lived in Durham for over 20 years. They'd never been to the cathedral.
Mm-hmm. I can quite believe that.
I think, you know, very large things quite often are simply taken for granted. So in the sociology of religion and in religious studies, I think there's very little serious research. There's been very little serious research undertaken in this area. And in anthropology, it's fairly sparse. I can think of Caroline Humphrey has done work on the built environment in the old Soviet Union. Roxanne Waterson has done work on the built environment in Indonesia. But I'm struggling to think of prominent anthropologists that have done work in this area. I think people in that sort of more diffuse area of religious studies are slightly more prominent, but when I think of texts even in that discipline, I'm thinking of texts that were written in the 60s, the 60s and 70s. So it's hard to know. I guess we'll come on to say a bit more about why I think it's extraordinary that it's been overlooked.
Yeah.
But I think the fact is, it's a field that's been little ploughed.
So, you mentioned that it was odd not to start with definitions. So I'm presuming that there are a few things here. There's there's built environment. This is quite a big one. There's religion. So perhaps there are a few key terms we should get out of the way.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's worth reminding people first that, well, before we come to define terms, that definitions are never right or wrong, but only more or less useful. So I guess if we start off with environment as such, I suppose I would define the environment as all of that which exists outside the human being, which is a pretty broad definition.
Mm-hmm.
I like broad definitions. You can always define more precisely, I think, when you come to the end of a piece of work, and not at the beginning. So the built environment, I suppose, would be that part of the environment which has been made by human beings. And I guess most prominent are those things which we call buildings.
Yeah.
And in terms of religion and religiosity, I guess the things that would come to mind would be cathedrals, temples, mausoleums, large shrines. But I think it's easy to remember, it's easy to forget that the built environment also concerns far smaller, less prominent structures, like, for instance, roadside shrines, which one could easily miss driving past. And gardens. Quite often people would include gardens in the built environment. And so it goes on. And I think really it would be up to the academic, to the researcher, to either include or exclude.
Yeah.
But I think there's an argument for being inclusive in what we'd include in the built environment. I think if it's made by people. So that would include, for instance, things like cave dwellings.
Yeah, you know, it's a cave that's natural, in a sense, but if it's been made into a...
If some work has been done on it, yeah, precisely, then I think it could be included. I think we might leave religion and spirituality to one side for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wouldn't want to define those directly. Hopefully the listeners...
we'll have heard plenty of them.
I think...
But I guess related to that... And this mightn't be something you wanted to answer now. What makes the built, particular parts of the built environment religious? Like, I mean, we've listed things which, you know, we would commonly say, oh, that's religious. But is it an individual? Does an individual interaction make it religious, or is it a sort of societal decision that certain buildings or certain parts of the built environment are religious or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. I hadn't thought that before the interview. Most obviously, buildings that are defined corporately as religious stand out. a cathedral, I think it would be hard not to agree that, you know, that was a... But I think you've touched on something far more interesting, and that's more specific constructions, if you like, promulgated by individuals. And I guess that touches on really the kind of methodology that I would say one needs to operate in order to get at this kind of these kinds of issues. It would be hard, I think, to get at individual constructions through questionnaires. So my work as an anthropologist has been ethnographic, as you'd expect, yeah, as many people working in religion. Ethnographers, regardless of their disciplinary, you think of cultural geographers and religious studies, people in gender, working in gender studies, and even sociologists and anthropologists, but also increasingly, I think, people who would once have called themselves theologians, mm-hmm, are more likely to use qualitative methods, participant observation, direct observation, those kinds of techniques. And I think in identifying micro constructions of the religious built environment, I think it would have to be done in those sorts of ways, the sorts of ways that Abby Day described yesterday in her talk, mm-hmm, and particularly participant observation. I think you'd really need to be standing next to somebody to understand what was going on. For instance, if you take roadside shrines, quite often that might just be the simplest token of commemoration. I think it's difficult to get at those minimal constructions through methods other than what we would think of as ethnographic.
Hmm. Yeah, because you ask someone, you know, do you have a shrine? Do you venerate things? No one's gonna. Well, very few people are gonna be. Oh yes, I know exactly the thing, and just be able to point to it. It takes that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Okay, so you've started to touch on there how you go about researching religion and the built environment, but maybe let's tackle that head on. I'm completely new to the field, but I've decided for some reason that I'm going to research religion and the built environment. How do I do it?
Okay, well, I've been working on that a little over the last... Well, I guess on and off over the last 15 years, because when I set out, I was researching Quakerism in a place I've called Dibdenshaw, and it was, in a way, it was building based. At the time, I was warden of the meeting, and I lived in the building, so I was very, very familiar with the building itself. But it was some time before I realised just how important the building was in the construction of religiosity by those people who were participants in the meeting, by the local Quakers. I guess I could start by distinguishing between the external and the internal. The thing that struck me one day when I was standing outside the meeting house was that it was foregrounded partly because of the enormous parish church that stood behind it. In a way, that brought out the differences between the two religious groups. And one day, I was taking a group of sixth formers to visit the meeting house. They have to do this now, part of their studies. Yeah. So I stood the group in front of the meeting house with the neo-Gothic parish church behind. The meeting house was built in 1970 and is modernist, glass, wood, brick, striking angles, and then there's the Gothic meeting house behind, if you can imagine it, and I asked them to compare the two. Well, in a way, that has driven my research for the last 20 years. It's certainly in relation to Quakerism, I guess, if I have any expertise, it's in that particular area, because what they did was show really clearly that Quakerism does indeed define itself and has been defining itself against Anglicanism since the start, since the 1650s. It's obvious in the 1650s because Quakerism was generated in a time of social upheaval, and it kicked against the established church. It defined itself against the established church. The Quakers attacked priests in the pulpit, and so on and so forth. They refused to pay church fines. They refused to attend church. but to see it so displayed so massively in, well, this was in 1990, was quite extraordinary. The students looked at the two buildings and first said, the Quaker building is plain. The Anglican building is ornamented. Okay, plain against ornamented is the sort of key binary opposition, if you like, representing the difference between Anglicanism and
Quakerism.
And then they said, oh, and the church is vertical. It has one of the highest steeples in the county. But the Quaker meeting house is horizontal. And they went on and on. There are lots of religious symbolism manifested in the building behind the Anglican building. We can see that. There are stained glass windows. I can see the saints. The building is called St. Peter's. There are the cross keys manifested everywhere. There are crosses, angels. Very densely symbolized in terms of Christianity. And there's no religious symbolism manifest in the Quaker. They knew that some of them had realized that the Anglican church was built on sacred ground. Quakerism isn't. One of them got that. For Quakers, all of life is sacred. There's no distinction between the sacred and profane. And in terms of civic differences, if you like, on top of religious differences, they noticed that the Anglican steeple had a clock, making it a civic building, that it had flags representing the civic and national culture, the Union Jack, and also the flags of the county, that it had wind vanes, which in a way is fulfilling a kind of civic duty. None of those things were... so that was an extraordinary start for me, and that, in a way, I'd already started researching for my PhD, but that gave me my first chapter.
Perfect.
That Quakerism was just, you know, maintained this playing the vis-a-vis, as David Boone, the American anthropologist, calls it, with Anglicanism. So it made me think, it made me consider far more carefully how the internal aspects of the building expressed and also helped construct religiosity for Quakers. And so, whereas comparing the two genres, if you like, the neo-Gothic Anglican parish church and the modernist Quaker building, if you like, was looking at the ideologies of the two groups, large-scale macro stuff, looking at comparing the interiors of the two buildings, but focusing on the Quaker meeting house, enabled me to get at more intimate, micro aspects of the built environment and its relationship to their religiosity. So that was very interesting. The thing that occurred to me first and foremost was the way in which the interior of the building was storied. I come to this I write about this in several papers. What I saw after probably a year's field work, certainly I was getting to the second year of my field work, I realized that the glue, if you like, or part of the glue that held the group together, I was asking myself, what enables Quakerism to continue? Why does it go on? You could ask the same thing about any group. What aids its memory? How does Quakerism as a local congregation remember itself, recall itself? And primarily it was, I thought, through narrative. And the narratives were spoken. People tell each other stories all the time, ongoing stories. How are you today? How's your leg? Mainly, not obviously religious, but perhaps religious in a broader sense. But also, these narratives were made concrete in the building itself. So they were made concrete in terms of corporate narratives. So the peace testimony was made concrete in posters and leaflets that were left around the place, in paintings relating to pacifism and the peace testimony, and other other similar testimonies were manifest corporate testimonies and were manifest in and around the building. And I'm not sure whether these were recognised consciously by people, but they were certainly recognised unconsciously. And so on and so forth. So there are two ways. You can look at the genres of different buildings, compare and contrast the genres of different buildings. You can look at the way that buildings help to construct narratives which people share and which bind them together, both in terms explicitly of religion and also more broadly in terms of social relationships and friendships, which is very important in relation to the Society of Friends. Comparing the two buildings also brought me for the first time onto I guess a structuralist approach, which I have some qualms about, and semiotics. In other words, looking for binary oppositions. I came across a brilliant piece of work by Pierre Bourdieu about that time. It's interesting because Bourdieu, after this piece, which was called The Berber House, became extremely critical of French structuralism and the work of Lévi-Strauss, a key French structuralist. But it's ironic that he's written probably the best single piece on the built environment from a structuralist perspective. And what he shows in looking at the Berber House is that the Berber House, in its binary oppositions, inside and outside, male and female, high and low, hot and cold, cooked and raw, all those kinds of binary oppositions, manifests, if you like, Berber cosmology. And he shows that brilliantly. And I tried to do, in one or two places, I tried to do the same thing in relation to Quaker buildings. So, for instance, if we take the just one part of a Quaker meeting house, the room in which worship takes place, often called the meeting room, these days it's a plain room. It's generally unornamented. The walls are bare, quite often white or grey. The seats, if it's a modern meeting house, the seats will be separate and in a circle. And the only other piece of furniture generally would be a table in the middle of the room on which you'd normally find a small vase of flowers and maybe one or two key texts. Okay, if you like, that homologizes the Quaker cosmology. There's very little to see, but what there is says an awful lot. So, for instance, the fact that it's plain tends to suggest that, well, it points to God within and not without. You won't find God on the walls or in the clouds. The Quakers on the whole say that there's that of God within all of us. God is imminent. The chairs are circular, which suggests, and on the floor, none are raised up, so it suggests a levelling, democratic tendency, priesthood of all believers, contrasting with raised pulpits in other Christian denominations. It's interesting that although furniture is minimal, there's always in the UK, and I think in similar liberal meetings in America and other parts of the world, there's usually a table in the middle, which demonstrably is a not altar, if you like. It's drawing attention, I would argue, to the fact that
there's nothing to draw attention to.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. In a way, by making the invisible visible. It becomes prominently comparable with or opposed to Anglican and Catholic liturgies. There's a fourth way, I guess, and I touch on these in one of my articles, which will be, we'll list in the book Reading Religion in Text and Context, called Reading Religious Architecture. A third way has been developed by an American scholar called Lindsay Jones, who wrote a brilliant book called The Hermeneutics of Sacred Architecture. I think this is an extraordinary book in which Jones uses a phenomenological or hermeneutic approach to look at the ways in which ritual and architecture are bound together. He argues that it's very difficult to understand ritual in any circumstances, in the religious sphere at least, without taking account of the built environment in which the ritual takes place. And together he calls the resulting phenomenon ritual architectural events, RAEs.
The research assessment exercise.
Yeah, it's a. I never think of the research assessment. I think of Lindsay Jones. I block out that horrible administrative nightmare that we're all facing. Okay, so his work is extraordinary, I think, because it brings together, for me at least, because it brings together two key interests: ritual and architecture or the built environment. And the book, it's in two volumes, isn't exactly flawless. Well, one thing I should say, one weakness I guess, is that he completely ignores the secular use of what we would think of as religious space. Just to go back to the Quakers for a moment, the meeting houses these days are, it's probably true of many other overtly religious buildings, is used for secular purposes throughout the week.
Yeah.
And he tends to ignore that. He concentrates entirely on religious buildings as in terms of their religious functions. And what he shows is that the buildings are dynamically involved in the rituals which they enclose. I think probably not true of historians of architecture, but generally the social sciences, we tend to think of buildings as rather static phenomenon. The point about Lindsay Jones's work is that he shows that no, buildings are active and participate in the construction and representation of rituals in a way which I haven't seen anybody else attempt. He also, the book is an enormous classification of religious architecture, very systematic.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yes. sorry about this.
It's quite hard.
There's something I wanted to mention, which I can't find, unfortunately. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The classification he attempts, he talks of architecture as orientation, and he gives a whole series of ways in which architecture acts as orienting, for instance, as homology, in other words, the way in which I just described the Quaker meeting house acting as a homology for the Quaker cosmology, if you like. In terms of commemoration, the ways in which architecture and the built environment commemorate, for instance, the divinity. And also, thirdly, in terms of ritual context. And he gives the example of religious buildings serving as theatres, if you like, in which dramas are performed. He's thinking, for instance, some of the examples he gives relate to ancient Greek ritual, but there are probably examples right the way through until the present. I like his book because it forms an extraordinary template for looking at all religious architecture. And as far as I know, I can only think of one paper that's been written on the basis of it, apart from my own work. Somebody looked at the door on which Luther pinned his theses in relation to Lindsay Jones's work. But it's been disappointing that nobody else has taken it up.
Yeah.
So there are four or five ways. I guess it's also important to remember that there's a wealth of sociology, if you like, that can be used in relation to buildings. So, for instance, Goffman's work mm-hmm. would be a case in point, and that whole symbolic interactionist school. Goffman talks, for instance, about front and back
yes.
areas.
And yeah, so the vestry and the...
Exactly, pulpit. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That I think that's it's useful to remember that. Bob Hillier, a cultural geographer, and cultural geographers were actually at the foreground of analysing the way in which buildings were used in the 70s and 80s. Bob Hillier talks about the depth of buildings.
Right.
And he measures depth in terms of, well, broadly speaking, doorways. And he's done interesting work in hospitals, for instance, and clinics, but you could do the same kind of thing with churches. I've tried this myself, where authority, if you like, resides deeper in buildings. So if you think of clinics, you go in through the front door and immediately meet the receptionist, a person of relatively little authority. Yeah. You think about hospitals even better. I remember recently I went in for a checkup in a hospital in Durham, and this was going through my mind. And by the time I reached the person who saw me, I'd crossed five thresholds before I met the person who was actually qualified to treat me. And I think quite often you can examine the way authority manifests itself within religious buildings according to the depth at which people work or reside
okay.
or are able to pass.
Yeah.
So not in terms of like a sort of physical doorway necessarily, but in terms of there are people who sit here, people who get to be at the front, people who get to go, and then there's that, you know, a lot of, say, Anglican churches, that altar rail, and there's a few people who get to go behind that.
Exactly that, exactly that. I used doorways first, and I backed off, and I think thresholds is a better word. And it's true, and I guess, again, to dwell on this comparison a little longer, because comparison is very important, to get from from the outside of a Quaker building to the heart, the meeting room, often you only have to you cross very few thresholds. I think that's telling in comparison with there are other religious buildings where you might have to cross a whole number and may never cross some unless you hold a certain status or position of authority.
Yeah, think of the Mormon temple, for example.
For instance, the Greek temples, which and also Aztec temples where you know thresholds were multiple.
We are coming to the end of our time. I've got about another 5 minutes safely, maybe slightly longer. I guess this is sort of an abstract question, which is you could take it to refer to academia in general, but is a lot of this, I mean, I remember it at school, you know, say learning about the cruciform shape of churches and why they were shaped like that. And for some reason, that's about the only thing I remember from religious studies, religious education at school. But I've always wondered, you know, how much, you know, whilst that may be the intended symbology, or when you talk about the Quaker meeting houses and things, how much that actually consciously filters down to the people using that space, like and so there could be things which are, I guess, originally planned, which then do they filter down to the sort of everyday use of the building, but then also when an academic goes in and then notices things like that, oh, there, that's clearly this and that, how much is that actually impacting upon the users, and how do you assess that impact and their awareness of the space?
That's a really good question. I think the thing to remember is that signs are multivalent, and no matter how much the constructor of the sign wants to have people read it in a particular way, people tend to be anarchic, and they're agents and will make their own decisions, and they may or may not be conscious, but we can never, I don't think we can ever be sure that people are reading signs in a particular way. That's for sure. I guess in a way the things that are truly crucial within religion will continue. So for instance, if the cruciform form of the church was crucial, then it would remain. But if you look at any modern churches, any modern Anglican churches, or within the wider Christian field, very, very few of them, probably almost none, are cruciform. Mm. So that form clearly isn't especially significant. The high altar at the east end of a church would have been thought of as critical. The thing is that signs change. Mm-hmm. Well, increasingly after Vatican II, the altar has been brought to the centre of buildings, rather like the Quaker Meeting House, which is interesting in itself. So I think, in a way, people will always read signs partly according to what they've been taught and how they've been socialised, but also according to their own more individual idiosyncratic upbringing, the way they, you know, the way that the things they've learnt within their own family, but also through their own trajectory. Mm. You know, people read and they observe. We're all different, and I think you can never be absolutely sure that people will agree corporately. I'll give you one final example if I have time. Again, from the Quaker Meeting House, it took me some time, but I tracked down the architect. Luckily enough, he still lived fairly locally. It was a 30-mile drive. I took plans with me, but he still had the plans of the building which he'd built at that point 25 years before, in semi-retirement, put the plans down. I said, I've always been interested in the roof. Yeah. People have talked about the roof, and the roof it's a very striking design. The roof has a white wooden facade which points upward, and that so upset one member of the meeting that they left. When the Quaker Meeting House was built, this person who'd been a long-standing member, had been a member of the Society of Friends for over 40 years, thought it was insufficiently plain, thought it was too striking and utterly unquakerly, and she left. And explained that to him, and I said, you know, it had religious significance for her. Quakerism is plain, that's a religious significance. And he said, oh, that's extraordinary. I said, well, so, you know, who suggested you build the building in that way? He said, well, nobody suggested it. I came up with a plan and showed it to the committee, and they said, that's great. So I said, well, okay, well, why did you come up with that design? And he took a piece of paper, tore it so that it was a square, folded it in half, and tilted it on one side, and said, it's an architectural principle. It's a cheap way of building a roof in an area of high rainfall. That was its significance. But I've heard other people talk about it as, you know, pointing towards God, and this is unquakerly, and the fact that the fenestration, the window beneath it, needs a cross to support it, that this is a... And he said, no. You know, all of these were technical matters. Yeah. None. I wasn't instructed to build it in this way. They're just matters of engineering. So I think people will read into buildings what they will, unless they're instructed or disciplined to read in particular ways. And in some ways, you know, those instructions are embodied. So, you know, we're made to sit in certain places in religious buildings, you know, we're instructed. But in other ways, you know, buildings can be commandeered, if you like, by the individual to mean all sorts of different things.
But again, as you were saying, it's the fact that people won't necessarily reflect on why they are sitting where they are sitting. So it doesn't have to be a conscious, it still is clearly impacting upon their engagement, the power of relationships and all of that.
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's regardless of what you think about the latent determinism of his work, Bourdieu's work is particularly important in his idea of habitus in exactly that. Instance is very useful. When Quakers come into the into the meeting. I'm not sure whether they're thinking, now I'm going to sit in a levelling way in a circle. But, you know, nevertheless, they are sitting in a levelling way. Yeah. You know, they're not facing a front, a hierarchy which is level, raised above them. They're sitting together in a circle, each in the gaze, each in one another's gaze. And I guess that has an effect on the way they see the world.
Yeah.
Whether they're aware of it or not, I think it's a moot point.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Peter Collins, for that. And there's certainly at least one, maybe more, freely available, the PDFs that we can link to, and then plenty more things if people want to delve further into this after that. But thanks so much.
All right, thanks. It's a pleasure.
Well, that was Peter Collins talking to Chris on the subject of religion and the built environment.
Yeah.
Good interview, Chris.
Yeah, thank you. And I liked... you got a lot of Quaker stuff in there, actually, which we haven't really covered on the podcast so far. So it was good to bring in stuff about sort of Quaker architecture and things like that. Well, I'm going to interview you a bit now, David, I think, because you have been sort of flying the Religious Studies Project flag down in the glorious Milton Keynes.
Yeah, the wonderful ancient borough of Milton Keynes. Yes, I was down taking part in the Open University's Contemporary Religion and Historical Context... No, Historical Perspective Conference.
How did that play out in terms of actual papers?
Well, the essential thing about the conference was that it was bringing scholars of contemporary religion specifically together with historians of contemporary religions. So there was a really kind of tight methodological subject focus, which I thought was great. I mean, obviously I use historical approaches and I'm interested in contemporary religion, so for me it was fantastic. There was 30 or 40 people there. It was a really kind of, everybody seemed to be on the same page in terms of what they were talking about. There was a few possible exceptions. As always, there were a lot of people who were essentially theologians arguing that we needed to take
religion seriously.
The phenomena of, we have to make sure that we're treating religious experience as a real thing. Or that...
unique.
Yeah. Sui generis. Spirituality. When we're studying spirituality, we need to take the spirit into account. These kind of things. Which
but you're
is
going to get that.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm getting kind of tired of that bobbins. Other than that, very good conference. A lot of really good, a lot of keynote speakers, which was really good. So a lot of very strong and longer papers as well. So that was good, including my own supervisor, Steve Sutcliffe. And Ronald Hutton.
Did my supervisor speak as well?
Kim did not speak. No, no. She spoke to me. We had roast pork together. It was a lot of fun. I was there in a sort of semi-official capacity. They waived my entry fee and are going to give me some expenses to cover my travel. And as a result, I did three interviews plus a round table, and I took photos and I put it on our Facebook page and tweeted about it and things.
So what are the interviews? You mentioned Ronald Hutton.
I interviewed Ronald Hutton about Triumph of the Moon and approaching contemporary religion historically. I interviewed Professor John Wolfe, a very learned man, on a broad overview of historical approaches to studying religion. I did a roundtable with Jasjit Singh and Paul Tremlett and some others on the idea of cross-cultural identity. So how do diaspora communities and second and third generation children of those diaspora communities negotiate their religious and cultural identities? And I did an interview with Paul-Francois Tremlett on Claude Lévi-Strauss, one of the most important anthropologists in the study of religion. It was a busy couple of days.
That's really good. Really good. And thanks so much to the OU for facilitating that, and to you for being able to go down. I would have loved to have been there. Unfortunately, other commitments kept me away, but I'm really glad that one of us was able to go.
Absolutely, I loved every minute of it, apart from the 5 o'clock start.
Yeah. Oh, well, the things that we do for our trade. Another organisation that are very helpful to us, of course, are the British Association for the Study of Religions. As always, thanks to them. Check out their website, basr.ac.uk. And I think I'll just set up what's happening next week. We've got another interview from Chris Silver, this time with Paul Williamson on serpent handling in Appalachia. So it's, I think it's going to be a really fun interview. Really yeah. Looking forward to it. Apart from that, we're almost, in fact, by the time this goes out, we might well have passed the 1,000 like mark on Facebook. We're past 980
so,
now.
So close. So
that's going to be a sweet day. And we will owe every one of you a thank you.
A midget gem.
Yeah, a midget gem. I think we can stretch to that. So, yeah, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, website, comments. Get in touch. Any ideas? And
thanks for listening.
Boom.